Hey, it's Greg Gutfeld. This is the one. It's been a while. I just spit on the mic. It's been like 3 weeks. I hit my head and got a concussion, so I was out for a little bit, but now I'm back. I still have headaches, and I sweat a lot, which is strange. Thank God I have an award-winning journalist, scholar, and prize-winning author with me, because he might have an answer to my problems. Robert Wright wrote this fantastic book that's out right now. It's called Why Buddhism is True, The Science and Philosophy of Meditation and Enlightenment. And there are always two things that I do when I have a great book. I write all over it. I'm constantly writing all over the place. I'm showing. Professor, how are you, by the way?
I'm doing fine. I'm sorry to hear about your head.
Yeah, you know, I want to ask you about something, because I bet you have an answer to this. I can't meditate. I've been meditating for like 10 years.
Whoa.
But ever since I hit my head, which was Monday of last week, I can't. It's like I try, and I don't get to that place where things are kind of empty.
Mm-hmm.
I don't get there, and I don't know why. It's just weird. Maybe it's just because it takes a while to get. I think it's because I still feel bits of pain. I got hit by a studio door right in the head right before going on to a show, and I went black for a little while, and then I had a big goose egg, and they said I had a mild concussion. Since then, they're like little weird things. But is there some kind of explanation why one would not be able to meditate?
I haven't been confronted with this particular problem before. I might recommend taking a couple of weeks off and not even trying, and then giving it a shot.
Yeah, maybe so. Anyway, enough about me. Your book's amazing. I kind of stumbled into you when I was editorial creative director of Men's Health. This has got to be back in the mid-90s. And Men's Health was a very successful service magazine for men. It was like Cosmo for men. So they had like 10 tips to be a better lover, 10 tips to get a raise. We were running out of ways to create tips because every magazine was using the same thing. I buy The Moral Animal, right, which is your fantastic book that came out in 95. And it's the new science of evolutionary psychology. And in there, it's basically service journalism that relies on natural selection. It's like it tells you, if you read the science, and tell me if I'm wrong, you can figure out how to be more attractive to the opposite sex, how to gain status, which is directly related to that, and just how to kind of like play that kind of game. And I started just mining your book, and then there was David Buss's book and Helen Fisher's book. Those were the three books that I – like after I got your book, I went back and read hers, which was Anatomy of Love was Anatomy of Desire anyway. So I read all three of them. But I used them to somehow impart advice in a magazine format. And in a weird way, that's kind of like what your new book is. I think your book is a service – is a piece on – it's a how-to book on how to look at life and how to make life better, right?
Yeah. I mean, I didn't think of either as self-help books mainly. This is probably closer to seeming like that than the other one. I mean, The Moral Animal – at that point, evolutionary psychology was kind of new, and we really were able to explain certain things about human nature for the first time, I thought, in a clear way as being like products of evolution. But yeah, ultimately it's news you can use, and I got a lot of that kind of feedback about it. Yeah,
yeah, it's basically summarize what your new book is about. It's basically the book is Why Buddhism is True, and the title can be confusing because it's kind of the way I see it. It's applying the tools from Buddhism to the curse of natural selection.
To the curse of being a product of natural selection.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, that is our creator for better or worse. And I should say, when I say why Buddhism is true, I'm not talking about the religious part of Buddhism. I'm not talking about reincarnation and so on. So this is actually compatible with any existing, you know, anybody's religious tradition, the stuff that's in the book or no religious tradition. But yeah, it's the – you know, I mean, Buddhism, the Buddha, we are told 2,500 years ago, set down to try to – deal with the human predicament and looked around and noticed that we are prone to like recurring suffering and recurring dissatisfaction, and we always want things to be a little better, and the thrill always fades and stuff like that. And in light of evolutionary psychology, I think it's a little clear why the human predicament is more or less as he described it. But in addition to having a diagnosis, he actually had a prescription. I mean, the Buddhism has a whole a whole, you know, path of teaching and practice that includes meditation, which is what's gotten most of the attention in the West, includes mindfulness meditation. And so I talk a lot in the book about meditation and how it, you know, how it works and how to think about it, how to, you know, approach it.
Yeah, and I think what's helpful is the problem when you start meditation is that, well, you're essentially lousy. And I consider when I read your book, it's like, yes, this is me. You stop doing it because it's hard. And you start beating yourself – when you're doing it, while you're meditating, you're actually beating yourself up while mm-hmm. you're doing it. When you're the whole point of meditation is essentially to clear – it's like – I call it a thought bouncer. When a thought starts coming in, it's like a video game and you try to like get that – you're like ejecting those thoughts. And so all of a sudden you're completely clear and then and then maybe once in 5 years something amazing happens and then you're cursed. Because you keep thinking about that thing, right. Like that happened to me, and then I started meditating, going like, "When's it going to happen?" The whole point is to erase kind of these thoughts, and meditation originally was, I mean, for a lot of people, including me, was for just stress reduction, but then it turns into something else, right?
Yeah, and one point of the book is that it can start out as therapy, a stress reduction, anxiety reduction, and it's very good at dealing with things like that. But if you want to follow the logic of it all the way to the depths of Buddhist philosophy and some of the kind of radical claims Buddhism makes about how kind of deluded we are about various things, about ourselves, about other people and so on, you can follow it that far. And,
right.
And it's almost like a slippery slope. It's like you start out – most people start out, you know, using it as self-help. They, mm-hmm. They've got issues with sadness, anxiety, whatever. But I tried to talk about that but also follow it further than that. You're right, though. The first – lesson of meditation when people first try is that like meditation is really hard, and the reason is your mind is just all over the place.
Yeah,
and you're not really in, you realize you're not really in charge of it because you try to do something simple like focus on your breath, mm-hmm. but the thoughts just won't stop. It's very hard.
Yeah, and what the weird thing about meditation is it takes you into this whole area where you start wondering where your thoughts coming from, and that's you address that too, because there's a lot of controversy over whether you're the CEO. Like people see themselves in a little chair, you know, in their brain working mm-hmm. The buttons. But what you do with when you're meditating is you see that's not the case. That there's like I think you talk about the idea of modules, mm-hmm. where these which thoughts are driven by feelings that come from various modules. That makes sense.
Yeah, the modular model of the mind has been especially popular in evolutionary psychology. And the idea there is that your mind is more like – I mean you think of yourself as being this conscious self that's in control. But the idea in the modular model is that actually there's all of these actors at a subconscious level that are kind of struggling for control of your mind. And the winner kind of like pops up to the surface. I mean a trivial example of this might be that you might kind of feel is like if you're at a cocktail party and you're talking to someone – mm-hmm. And you're kind of interested, but you can see the hors d'oeuvres,
yes.
Right? And it's like you can literally feel the struggle of the part that wants to like impress the person you're talking to or whatever, doesn't want to offend them.
Yeah.
And the part is that like I want food. And that really would be in this model two different kind of actors, two modules in your mind kind of fighting it out.
That was the best example in your book when you described it. It's like, yes, that makes total sense. And it's like you can actually see the thoughts competing for the same thing. And we are doing that all the time. I thought that was like a great kind of practical way of explaining something that might be complicated. It made me see it better than I'd seen it before when other people talk about it. The weird thing – okay, the thing about your book is you're taking something, the practice of meditation, and applying it to probably the world's – human's biggest problem, which is like how we are tricked into doing things that are bad for us. So how does meditation deal with, say, these module thoughts that are coming at us, telling us, like, for example, I want to eat – you always use the I want to eat a donut.
Mm-hmm.
Now, normally that's a good thought to have because you have to eat. But what happens is you don't need to keep thinking that.
Yeah.
So it's like a trick. And the trick is based on the idea that we need to be constantly gratified. Is that kind of
– Yeah. I mean we have two problems. One is that natural selection didn't want us to be enduringly happy to begin with. And when I say want, I'm being kind of metaphorical. It's not a conscious being apparently. But But the point is, like, if you imagine an animal that eats one meal and then just sits there and goes, man, that was good.
Yes.
And just never wants more.
Right.
If the gratification never fades, the animal will die of starvation. But in mentioning donuts, you're alluding to the second problem, which is that now we're in an environment where you have a lot of food that's not nutritious to begin with.
Right.
And is just designed to get you kind of addicted with little nutritional value and so on. And the whole – I mean, look, the internet, our smartphones, mm-hmm. more and more things are designed to get us addicted. And so you've got – it's like we are kind of suboptimal beings to begin with from the standpoint of our own happiness just by design. But then you put us in this environment where it's even harder mm-hmm. To have any kind of stability of happiness.
Yeah, and there are different areas of this. There is food, there's status. When you're talking about the internet, think about internet porn, which is just like this bottomless hole mm-hmm. that preys upon this like trick that you need to have this stuff, and it's like and it's. That's probably a really good example of how mm-hmm. destructive it can be. Yeah. You end up somewhere in this, I don't know, blind alley.
And it also illustrates that, you know, we weren't built to consciously get genes into the next generation, right? I mean, the basic problem we have is that animals are designed to do one thing and one thing only, get genes into the next generation.
Right.
If not being happy will do that, then we will be designed to not be happy. If having illusions about things will help genes get into the next generation, then illusions there will be. And there are some, but we're not designed to think our mission is to get genes into the next generation. And pornography is a perfect example.
Mm-hmm.
If you think about the environment of our evolution – well, if you saw an attractive body, it would be a real body.
Right.
You wouldn't be like wasting your time, so to speak, from
yeah.
a reproductive standpoint, right,
right? Right.
And so it's just another example of how the modern environment messes with us.
Yeah. And that's so the book is interesting because I saw it as kind of a breakthrough that it helps people. I guess, steer themselves – once you are able to identify this thought as being a product of a feeling, which is a product of some antiquated – natural selection, something left over, it's kind of easier, I guess, to let it pass. And that's meditation.
Yeah. I mean, meditation teachers, especially in mindfulness meditation, will emphasize that to begin with, that when a feeling – if you're meditating and a feeling kind of comes up, just – observe it, let it be, don't run
yeah.
from it, but
yeah.
on the other hand, don't follow whatever it tells you to do. So that's kind of a message from the Buddhist standpoint to begin with, and I think understanding where the feelings come from, why we have anxiety, why it sometimes is productive and so on, can make it easier to kind of not engage with unproductive feelings.
Yeah, I mean that's the – when I would say as an amateur who meditates and is – constantly dealing with, I would say, like, if it's so funny. I've recommended this book a lot to people, and I always recommend it to people when they say that they have problems sleeping, because they always say that it's insomnia, but when you ask them, no, it's racing thoughts. It's like they mm-hmm. go, I can't, you know, I didn't sleep at all last night, but it's always racing thoughts. And if you ask anybody, they will admit they have racing thoughts. And this book is kind of designed to eliminate a lot of the cars from the race,
right?
You know, and so if you're lying, like, and I guess the take home advice for the book is that this is not that, it's not that hard if you admit that it's hard,
right?
Right, and so you go, okay, so you sit there and you concentrate on your breathing, and then the thoughts come, and all the thoughts that are these racing thoughts that prevent you from meditating are kind of driven by natural selection. So you're thinking about your job, that status.
Right. Right.
You're thinking about a relationship,
right.
that sex sex, and then or maybe you're thinking about food. I don't know.
Yeah.
But once you take that time and just kind of stare at it in your head, it just kind of like goes.
It loses its power to control you, and gives you more choice in the matter.
Yeah,
yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Now, I personally kind of when I first got into meditation went. To boot camp. I went to a one-week silent meditation retreat
right.
because I was just so bad at meditating.
Yeah.
You don't have to. And some people actually take it up fairly naturally. And, and now there are these apps, and so there's a lot of ways. There's a lot of ways you can do it. You know, 10% happier app, but my first big experience was a retreat, and that is super intense. I mean, if people are into like experimenting with extreme sports for the mind, I would say if you've got the time and you want to try like a 1 week, you know, absolutely silent meditation retreat, most people wind up, in my experience, they're glad they did it.
Yeah, I would be terrified. I stayed at a monastery in the late 90s for an article for like a week in Gethsemane.
Yeah, that's where Thomas Merton, the Catholic mystic, used to go.
So I went there and, you know, for a week. And after 2 days, and went to all the prayers, the Vespers and stuff. The whole point of the story was, and this is like in the late 90s, this is before we really got attached to technology, but the whole point was, could I be alone? And I realized I couldn't. I couldn't do it. I ended up leaving and driving to Lexington or something into a bar, spent 3 hours at a bar and then came back.
That's not the intended effect.
No, it's not.
Yeah, when I first went on, I told my wife I was doing a retreat. She said, "Are you kidding? You can't even take a shower without turning on the radio."
Yes. Yeah. That's true. That's kind of – I mean, that's a big thing. You also – towards the end of the book, there's so many great things in here that I want to ask you, but I don't want to keep you too long. Your big worry – you kind of get into this place where you're talking about saving the world.
Yeah, I'd like to do that.
And it's an interesting – I know. It's an interesting thing because I think that in politics, you talk about basically the antagonism loop. This feedback mechanism where one side is angry at the other, the other again. I see that. I work in that. Right. I see that every single day. And I try to it's part of team sport politics. It's you know what a good example is? The argument over divisiveness. When I'll be on the Five and I'll say the Democrats, Juan Williams, they're so divisive. They won't listen to Donald Trump, and Donald Trump is doing this, and then Juan will go, Donald Trump's the most divisive political character in history. And then I'll go, no, President Obama was divisive. And then you were right. Actually being divisive over divisiveness.
Yeah.
And we can agree that there's divisiveness, but we can't agree we need to pick a side even when we're talking about picking sides.
Yeah. No, the psychology of tribalism is finally starting to get the attention I think it deserves.
Yes.
And I talk about it in the book because I think meditation can help here. But it is the great – you know, I mean, domestically, obviously, there's all this political polarization that people are rightly talking about. But, you know, any kind of conflict, sectarian conflict abroad, war – it's all the same psychology, and it's subtler than people feel. I mean, when they think of like what evolution can tell us about why there's human conflict, they think of hatred and they think of rage. It's a lot subtler than that. It's like about once you put somebody on the other side of the tribal line, how you process information about them in a way that makes it hard to ever think about them in a different way again.
Exactly. You know, and it's – I saw this – I mean, I see it every day. If you you could be like, you know, the line that someone will always say to you, I used to like you, but, or I used to like you until. It's like a comedian will go on a stage and make a lot of really disgusting, dirty jokes, and everybody's laughing until one of those jokes hits you personally.
Yeah.
Like, he'll make a joke about psoriasis, and now it'll be one person in the audience. I used to like that guy, not anymore.
And he went too far.
He went too far. And so with politics, it's like if you decide that you're not getting behind somebody, then it's like, I used to like you, but, and then they look at you differently.
Yeah.
You are not like, I saw a picture of a guy who was at a book signing for one of my books, burning one of my books. And it was like, I was shocked because of, I was highly critical of Trump during the debates before he became president. And I was really hard on him. And I was like, this kid burned my book.
Yeah. Right. No, it's intense. And each side polices its own side and expels people when they, you know, if they say the wrong thing. I mean, you know, I'm not a Trump supporter historically. Yeah. I'm like a liberal. And I'm sure if some people find out, I'm like talking to a guy at Fox News.
Of course.
They'll say, well, I hope you challenged him on what a – and I'll be like, actually, I was talking about my book. I thought that was a wiser use of my time.
Exactly. Yeah. It's fun. It is funny, though. How do you see – you have this in your book. And I do think you're right. I think you're right that the more people talk and understand what tribalism is, the better we are. But it seems like I mean, you're hopeful. I think the last mm-hmm. sentence of your book, you were very hopeful about what can happen. I don't know if I'm as hopeful as you are.
I'm guardedly hopeful. I try to sound, you know, I mean, I do think there's a path forward. Mm-hmm. I mean, I feel I'm kind of in the middle of this. I mean, three of my four siblings voted for Trump.
And really?
Yeah.
Wow.
So I'm trying to get people on my side to see the other side. I started something called the Mindful Resistance Newsletter. Resistance meaning yes, we were not fans of Trump, but mm-hmm. but if you go crazy over him, and you don't do the work of understanding why people support him, mm-hmm. you know, because it's always tempting to say, oh, they're all racist, they're all this, they're all that. And I'm encouraging us not to assume it's that simple, and look at things a little more calmly. And I do think in general meditation can help people on either side of a tribal divide mm-hmm. Just see things more clearly.
Yeah, that's what I was wondering. How do you tie that in to this bigger, like, you know, this existential problem? Is that can somehow these tools actually fight this feedback loop or this antagonism? Maybe. I mean, if I'm – like, I'm considered kind of a right-wing libertarian, and I'm – you know, I have to say I went through a lot with the – I learned more in the Trump campaign than any time in politics because it forced me to let go of ideology. He's not an ideologue. He's like he's a lot of things, but he could be a Democrat. He could be a Republican. I think he watched a lot of Fox. Mm-hmm. I think that's his ideology as Fox.
You mean in the end – you mean after he came – yeah. Well, see, I mean he was saying things about foreign policy I liked during the campaign. That hasn't really panned out in the end. But, yeah, he's an interesting figure and the story's not over.
It's definitely not. It's not – the one thing that I – you know, I had people in my family that voted for Trump. I didn't vote for Trump. And I had to do – I had to ask myself – I did an experiment and thought about – and thought, okay, what would my mother's my mother passed away. I would think, like, what would she think of Trump? She would be laughing hysterically when he's on TV. She would just be laughing. And then my brother-in-law, whenever he would talk about Trump, my sister goes, my husband Mark won't shut up about Trump, and he's always laughing. And I'm going, like, okay, so what I'm missing here is the humor. If I stop thinking about him as this political figure and more like a host of a Comedy Central roast, it's a lot easier. And I started doing that, and that was kind of a way of stepping back and then understanding things, that words are different than deeds, and that to focus more on the deeds and just accept the fact that these words mean a lot less to a lot of people than perhaps to me, and that I have to like when a joke that he says bugs me. My friends are going, shut up, you've said worse. And I go, yeah, but he's running for president. And he goes, that doesn't matter anymore. And I go, okay. So I had to educate myself on that. Yeah, that's it. It hasn't been written. it's an amazing. And also, there was a part in your book that I really liked that has to do kind of with Trump and also other politicians. When you overestimate disposition and underestimate situation.
Oh, yeah.
I think that's a big deal.
I'm glad you focused on this. I think, you know, people have heard a lot about cognitive biases like confirmation bias, mm-hmm. where you only see evidence that supports your pre-existing view. You don't see evidence that contradicts it. And that's important.
Yeah.
And I think actually meditation can help there because I think that's ultimately driven by feeling. Like if you see something on Twitter like, yeah, that confirms my view, it feels good. That's why you retweet it without examining. So confirmation bias is important, but what you're alluding to is another so-called cognitive bias called attribution error. It's a little more complicated, but I think it's super important. Originally, the idea was this, that people tend to, in explaining people's behavior, they put too much emphasis on disposition and not enough on situation. So if I'm standing at a checkout, in a checkout line, and the guy in front of me is being rude to the clerk, I think, oh, that guy's a jerk. I don't think, well, maybe he just got horrible news about his family or something, which could be true. So,
right.
But it turns out it's actually more complicated than just a general tendency to put too much emphasis on disposition. The way it works is with our friends and allies, if they do something good, we attribute it to their disposition. That's the kind of person they are.
Right.
If they do something bad, it's like, oh, they didn't get their nap or it was peer group pressure. With our enemies – on the other side of the tribal line, if they do something bad, we go, yeah, that's the kind of person they are. If they do something good, we explain it away. He's trying to impress some woman or whatever. And when you think about it, this is what makes it so hard. Once you've defined somebody as an enemy, what makes it so hard to change that evaluation? Because anything they do, your mind is going to use it to confirm your pre-existing image of them as an enemy. And I describe a time when on a meditation retreat, I thought of like one of my worst enemies in the world, somebody you've probably heard of in media.
Yes. Is it somebody I actually know?
I doubt you would be hanging out with this person. You may have.
What's this area of specialty?
I shouldn't. The only clue I'll give you is he was a victim of the recent Me Too.
Oh,
so his name was in the news.
Gotcha.
But
Garrison Keillor.
But I can't. No, I can't go further. Anyway, the point is, wait, you're getting me off message. I'm trying to tell you like about this breakthrough I had where I thought about this person who's been my nemesis, and I actually had some sympathy and thought about look. Whatever circumstances growing up, you can imagine how he would have been somebody who on the junior high playground is like not doing well, right? Mm-hmm. And like this leads him to overcome. So whatever the story is, he wound up being a kind of person who rubs me the wrong way. There was this ability, through meditation to think of him a little differently.
Yeah.
And
it's funny. It's kind of like the way people respond to like a news of a criminal. If you don't know the criminal, it's like bad guy. Put him away, but then you see the family.
Oh, totally.
That family is like, he was, he had a bad upbringing.
Yeah.
Or just the lawyer. But that's kind of like what this is. It's like,
Well, and that, it gets back to disposition and situation. If it's somebody in your family,
yeah.
You're aware of all the stuff that led them into the situation where they did something wrong, right? And you're like, it was just a bad break.
Yeah.
He was in the company of this person and blah, blah, blah. But if it's just somebody you read about in the news, you're like, oh, bad guy.
Yeah.
And I'm not, we do have to punish people as a practical matter. You don't, but still, I think it's always good to try to understand what led people to do what.
While I'm doing this last few minutes of the interview, I've had that, I have a module that's trying to figure out who the guy is.
I'm like, we'll talk afterwards.
Yes. One last question, because I sense that you are religious. I kind of believe. I mean, maybe you're spiritual.
Not in a conventional way, but I was brought up Southern Baptist. I'm not conventionally religious, but I have what I consider my spiritual worldview. Yeah.
Yeah. You kind of mentioned it's in the last graph of the book. I think a hidden order. What do you mean? Care to elaborate?
Well, William James, the great psychologist, said the essence of religion, or one characteristic of religion, is the idea that there is an unseen order and that our supreme interest lies in harmoniously adjusting ourselves to that order. And different religions have different views of what the order is. But Buddhism makes this kind of amazing claim that the reason we suffer and the reason we make other people suffer is because we don't see the world clearly.
Mm-hmm.
And if you flip that around, what that means is if you clarify your vision, if you see the world more clearly and get closer to the truth about things, you will become a happier person and a better person morally. And it's just amazing that the universe would be built like that, so that kind of truth, the objective truth about things, and happiness and moral truth can converge, can naturally align. And that's the order I'm talking about.
Well, I got to say, I heartily recommend Why Buddhism is True, Robert Wright. It's a fantastic book. And also, if you like that, I read two other of your books. I read The Three Scientists. I read that a while ago.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, was that your first book? And then I read Moral Animal, which I also recommend. Should I read Non-Zero? That looks interesting.
I encourage everyone to read all my books.
Yeah, that's a stupid question asking an author. Should I read your book? Yeah. There's some books I wrote that I tell people not to read. The first two books I wrote, which were like humor books that were based on articles from Men's Health.
Yeah, no, I have told certain people. I don't think you'll get much out of this, honestly. I mean, different people are different, you know?
Yeah, but I got a lot out of this, as you can see. I actually wrote, like, I wrote so much stuff. This is, I wrote there, and I was looking at this, Thought Bouncer. And I think that was, like, an idea for an app, Thought Bouncer. It's something that makes you change your thought. But I still haven't gotten, I haven't gotten any further.
I would get that URL nailed down, yeah. thoughtbouncer.com.
Yeah, because something that, like, it's like, yeah, you're right. Once I say this on here, it's over. That's a stupid thing to do. We'll have to edit that out.
Yeah.
Well, thank you, Professor Wright. This was a pleasure.
Thank you, Greg.
Thanks for coming in.
This was great. I appreciate it.
Awesome. Thanks.